Travel presented by Vintage Guitar Magazine with your host, me, James Patrick Regan, otherwise known as Jimmy from the Deadlies. And today I'm speaking with Brad Talinsky and Chris Gill, writers of the book Blow by Blow, The Jeff Beck Story, and both guitarists in their own right. The two share stories that are in the book, such as Jimmy Page's role in Jeff's career. The two talk about the collaborations Jeff did late in his career with Rod Stewart and Brian Wilson, and early in his career with Elton John, and they take us through what became of Jeff's gear. Chris describes meeting Jeff for the first time at his home and having to scale a wall to get in to speak with him. And they talk about his love interest in the States on his early tours, Mary Hughes, a star of 60s B-movies. Chris discusses Jeff's car collection and his relationship with hot rod builder Roy Brizio, and they also talk about Jeff's hearing loss. Finally, Brad and Chris take us through their own personal guitar and amp collections. Blow by Blow, The Jeff Beck Story is available wherever you buy books. Please subscribe, like, comment, share, and most of all, review this podcast. I'd really appreciate it. And please support Vintage Guitar Magazine and all the wonderful things they do for us guitar players, because they do so many wonderful things for us guitar players. Oh, hey, if you want to support the show, we have a Patreon. It's patreon.com/haveguitarwilltravelpodcast. Here's my friends, Brad and Chris. Brad and Chris, it's very nice to meet both of you, and I really enjoyed the book. The book was fantastic.
Thanks.
A lot of insight that unfortunately Bob Lefsetz didn't appreciate, I guess.
it's not for Bob. This is not for Bob. You know, it's I just put it this way: some people are creative, some people are destructive, and Bob is the latter.
Well, nevertheless, it's a fantastic book. It's a fantastic book. The thing that struck me just right out of the gate was I didn't realize that Jimmy Page had played such a function in Jeff's upbringing as a guitarist.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of an interesting, you know, little world going on there. I wanted to, you know, I think both Chris and I wanted to show the interplay between Jeff, Eric Clapton, and Jimmy Page. I mean, there is a genuine, you know, especially in the beginning, sort of a dance between those three different forces in British rock. But Jeff and Jimmy stayed friends throughout their entire life. And one of the first times I met Jeff actually was in an interview that I did with him and Jimmy together.
Oh, wow.
And it was just terrific because they were both talking about that early era that nobody really knew much about, you know, in a great amount of detail.
Yeah, and I thought just with no background whatsoever, I always thought it was Eric Clapton that played a bigger role in Jeff's upbringing as a guitarist.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, it was Jimmy that gave Jeff his first big break by recommending him for the Yardbirds.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Later on in the book, you talk about the collaborations he had with Rod Stewart again for the last time and with Brian Wilson. Was there any demos with Rod Stewart or Brian Wilson that were recorded?
Well, I know with Brian there was stuff recorded, but with Rod, I don't think so much. I think you know, there was kind of a lot of interaction between them throughout. You know, especially, you know, during the 80s, there was, you know, obviously he appeared on some albums, and of course people get ready and that sort of thing. But yeah. I think they were more concerned about touring together than doing any actual recording projects at the time.
Hey Chris, I'm going to jump in there really quick.
Sure.
Sorry. But actually, Jeff and Rod did work on an album together right there, you know, towards the end of his career. And they just couldn't I think I'm just a little more familiar with that section. Because
yeah, I think so. Yeah.
I worked on that section. But Rod and Jeff were working on a record, and I think they got a good, you know, 2/3 of the way through it. When, you know, Rod sort of felt like he wasn't able to get the album that he wanted. And I think it was more Rod at that point. He made sort of an excuse about his wife being with child.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. 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 I mean, there's so much stuff. I sometimes confuse the tours and the record projects too. So especially with Rod, it's like just come and go, come and go.
Yeah. But Rod said it was a question of both of them at, by that point in their career, both of them usually knew what they wanted, and they just could not get together on what that was.
Yeah. You guys do a fantastic job of describing the gear he used throughout his career. And what became of is there a stockpile of Jeff Beck owned gear somewhere?
It pretty much got sold. It got auctioned off by Christie's last year, actually. I actually worked on some of the auction with authenticating stuff and answering some questions about things. There's some mystery items in there, including like a pair of humbucking pickups that they weren't really sure what. Unfortunately, the catalog didn't reflect my input to a certain degree because one of them was heavily modified. It was a PAF, but it had colored wires and it was wired for, for four conductor, which original PAF would have been two conductor wiring. But most of that stuff got liquidated. I think there was only a handful of items that his wife held on to. I'm not sure what happened. There was a plastic Mockaferry guitar that was supposed to go up for auction that Jimmy Page had given to Jeff.
Okay.
But either his wife held on to that because of the sentimental value of it, or Jimmy said, like, oh, I'm taking it back,
Sure.
Which is a very typical Jimmy Page thing to do. Yeah.
He's not using that anymore, is he?
Exactly. I gave that to Jeff. I should have first dibs on that.
Are you guys both based here in the Bay Area?
No. We're both East Coasters.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I'm just outside of Manhattan.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
And which one of you was that met with Jeff the first time at the castle?
That was me. Yeah.
Where you had
I had to climb the wall. It was a brick wall, rather tall brick wall to go over, big iron gate, wow. Locked up with padlock, with a combination on it. And his manager, we pulled up to it, and I'm all excited. I'm first of all in jet lag. At that time, I did live in the Bay Area.
Okay.
And I flew from San Francisco because I was working for Guitar Player Magazine. I flew from San Francisco to London, Gatwick Airport, and stayed at an airport hotel. And his manager picked me up bright and early the next day, and everything. And I'm still bewildered, and drove a good hour out to, from Gatwick Airport to where Jeff lived. So he was not very centrally located as far as, being close to the London music scene or anything. He spent a lot of time in London, but he was definitely far removed from that where he, lived day to day. But we got there, and I'm like, I'm all excited, and like, oh, good, and he's sitting there messing with the lock, and I see this look of frustration on his face, and I'm just like, uh-oh, because I had heard how difficult Jeff could be, and that was like my firsthand, right there is, you close proximity, you can feel his presence and everything like that, and all of a sudden it's like, and he had to go into town, try and call him up, and Jeff didn't pick up the phone, last resort was to climb over the wall.
Yeah.
Which actually, in the long run, ended up being the coolest thing to do because I got to just absorb it slowly as opposed to, a quick whiz down this rutted path, just a couple, two ruts in the dirt, basically, leading up to this place. I got to walk up to it and kind of absorb all the environment that he lived in. And then you come around the bend where these trees were kind of blocking my view, and then you come around the bend, and like, there's the house, built in the 1500s. He'd actually been restoring it to its original condition.
Wow.
It had all these facades built in over the top of it over the years, depending on fashion for architecture over, various centuries. And so he stripped all that stuff away. And so I see that, and then I see the hot rods over on the other side at this other building, just up the bend. Uh-huh. And then, of course, big, huge wooden door, knock, knock, knock,
Yeah.
Opens the door, there's Jeff. And he turns back and starts to walk away. And it's just like, what the heck,
Yeah.
So, and of course, go ahead. You can read in the book about the icebreaker, but it was, once I got past that shell, it was really, he was very open.
Yeah. And do you find that with a lot of the people you interview where there's an icebreaker that gets you through it to the speaking openly?
It depends on the person, really. Some people are all too welcoming, and great right off the bat. Some people, you got to kind of coax a little bit out of them. And some people, you talk to for 10 minutes until you get the fuck out. So, which fortunately only happened to me once or twice. But
You know, Slash is great. Billy Gibbons, all those guys are great.
Sure.
You get into some, sometimes the legends, you know, you have to dig your way in a little bit.
Yeah. You know? But yeah, people like Slash and Gibbons are just like, you know, once you kind of get past the door, it's like I used to, unfortunately or fortunately, I don't know, I used to go out drinking with Slash, believe it or not, in Manhattan, and the worst hangover I had in my life came via Slash, you know. And then Billy Gibbons was just, he would take you off on these adventures that are just memorable and weird.
You mentioned early on that Jeff had three injuries to his head that were pretty severe, and you've find that him being difficult may have been a result of those, or was he just a shy person to start with?
Well, this is the thing. So, you know, what we wanted to do with the book is to paint a picture and allow people to some degree use their own, pull their own assumptions from it. Right.
Yeah.
And the thing about Jeff is, what we wanted to do is paint a picture of him as being, a great artist, but a guy that, had his challenges as well.
Sure.
And so he's been portrayed as this sort of angry young man in a way, but we wanted to peel some of that back and show that the circumstances around it that might have caused him to behave certain ways, you know?
Yeah.
And, there were so many different reasons back then. Touring conditions were awful.
Sure.
You know, the pressure to create a new hit single every 3 months. And then on top of that, he had a series of head injuries that were really serious. You know, they were no joke.
Yeah.
And on top of that, he would also have, different sort of viral and, issues, problems with his throat. So there was always this situation where he'd have to travel long distances, less than ideal circumstances. He was a guy, there's no question, who was fussy about his guitar sound and the way it sounded on stage. And all these things that just worked against you in the 60s and the 70s until, the touring business got more sophisticated.
Yeah.
So, we tried to show in the book, and sometimes it's funny, and sometimes it's not.
Yeah.
How we would get cranky and why we would get cranky. Like, for instance, like probably a lot of your listeners don't really know this, but when bands toured in the 60s, unless you were like maybe the Beatles or something, many of the times you couldn't even, you just traveled in a station wagon or a bus and you couldn't really carry your gear with you.
Yeah.
So you depended on the promoters to provide amplifiers. And it was just primitive. It was just a mess, And half the time Jeff would show up and there on stage would be some weird amp that they got from some local music store that may or may not have worked,
Yeah.
And you're trying to play Shapes of Things or over underside down on this, cruddy amp. It's going to put you in a mood,
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And a lot of people don't realize that Jeff had the opportunity to play with Elton John, which I caught me off guard.
Yeah, that was he was sort of in between bands at that point and wasn't sure what direction he was going to. Uh-huh. And just by happenstance, he went to this club. A friend said, "Oh, you should go check out this singer-songwriter piano guy." This was in the right after Elton had released his first record and was still, he wasn't very famous then. He was sort of an up and coming guy.
Yeah.
And Jeff went to this club basically thinking he was going to see this moody, introspective, quiet, musician. And Elton, even back then, came out like with guns ablaze and playing more like, Jerry Lee Lewis than say Carole King or something like that, And Jeff's was just stunned because he was a huge fan of like Jerry Lee Lewis and Little Richard. He just got it immediately and said, what's missing in Elton's band? You know, because Elton at that time just had him on piano, a bass player and a drummer.
Yeah.
And he goes, that guy's got no guitar player. And he goes backstage, you know, immediately and offers up his services. And it doesn't quite work out. I sort of want to leave the rest of the story to your, you know, to the readers to pick up when they get the book. But, you know, at first Elton and Jeff get along great.
Yeah.
But then right before they're ready to go on tour, Jeff has a few reservations. Elton goes to America by himself, gets this incredible review in, I think, the LA Times, and becomes almost a superstar overnight. And Jeff sort of is out on the whole thing.
Yeah. And you also document Jeff's relationship with a movie star early on. That would be familiar to a lot of people my age, our age, just from being in the B movies and the surf culture.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, what can you say? Mary Hughes. It's like, you know, of course, Jeff wasn't the only one. You know, she got around quite a bit as well as Jeff did, you know. But he had his moment, and she got, you know, immortalized in Psycho Daisy. So all good.
Yeah.
Jeff, from the time he was like a kid and he saw this movie, The Girl Can't Help It, that turned him on to rock and roll and rock and roll guitarists a lot. But Jane Mansfield was also in the movie.
Sure.
And he got turned on to Gorgeous Blonde. So when he came to America and ran into
the Gorgeous Blonde,
the actress Mary Hughes, you know.
Yeah, unfortunately, it made the cutting room.
The fact that he was married at the time.
Yeah.
He didn't let that stop him.
No, he didn't. But it was kind of interesting because there was an interview with Charles Char Murray that Jeff had done in 74 before Blow by Blow came out. And it's a great quote, and it actually ended up in my bio that I wrote for the Christie's auction. Unfortunately, I had to kind of tone it down a little bit in deference to Sandra, his widow. Uh-huh. But it was like, you know, music, cars, and sex. That's all it's about for me. Because it got you. Charles was asking me about the money. You know, are you doing this for money? How are you going to make money? Whatever. And he's like, I don't care about money. It's music, cars, and sex. You know, and that's all right there. And The Girl Can't Help It. Yeah. You know, it's like there's all the music. You know, there's Little Richard. There's Gene Vincent in his blue caps. There's Eddie Cochran.
Sure.
You know, and on and on. And there's that beautiful red convertible, you know, and there, and there's Jane Mansfield. So I think as a young impressionable teenager, it's just like, that's what I want from life. You know?
did they sell off the cars that he'd built when he passed away as well?
I have not been able to make heads or tails of that. I know there were plans to sell them, but I have never heard. Now that may have been more private than the Christie's auction. I don't think he wanted to go the route of like a Barrett Jackson auction or anything like that. I think because Roy is well connected, you know, he builds street rods and everything in South San Francisco, and they were good by December. So, and you know, Jeff had some cars actually out in storage at Roy, all under the radar.
So I worked for Bill Graham and ended up seeing a lot of those hot rods that Jeff had built.
Yeah, that was quite a show. I did allude to that in the book. About, you know, that was 95, I believe you're talking about.
This would have been earlier.
It was earlier. Oh, okay.
This was in the 80s.
Oh, okay. Wow. Well, it was a common occurrence for that to happen. Cause when I saw the 95 tour at Shoreline and also some of the other shows, Concord and, you know, even down in LA at the Greek Theater and San Diego, the car clubs all kind of followed them around and everything. But Shoreline in particular was like a major turnout, and you know how it is there. It's kind of there down by the lower end of the bay and everything like that. You just heard this rumble coming up the road because you kind of have to come up this winding road to get to the you know, the amphitheater. And there was just all these beautiful candy colored cars, you know, and Carmine Appice was there too and everything like that. So it was really quite a turnout of, you know, friendlies for Jeff, you know, so to speak.
Did Jeff suffer from hearing damage?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it was bad throughout, you know, pretty much from early on, you know, starting in the 70s, but it really got bad when he toured with Stevie Ray Vaughan.
Okay.
And which is kind of funny because I don't know if it was from the encores more than anything, because Jeff talked about, like, you know, because Stevie had this big, huge wall of amps. He had Marshalls and Dumbles and Fenders and all kinds of stuff, you know, just all kinds of different amps up there.
Yeah.
And Jeff had two twins, you know, and they weren't even like, they were the twin twos. That was his rig that he was playing through. It was still loud, though, but that really got him. And then, of course, when he had that unfortunate incident with, he was rehearsing with Guns N' Roses in Paris. Yes,
exactly.
For this big deal, and Matt Sorum hit the drums and it just blew Jeff away. And that just really put him over the top. And that's, you know, and then we talk about how that inspired him. Or just drove him in a certain direction because he couldn't really handle the loud volume. He was telling me then, you know, in 92 that, you know, I don't know if I'm ever going to be able to do another Guitar Shop style tour again. Now, of course he was, but he was really concerned about it. And his solution was to kind of do this very retro rockabilly record, you know, where he's the only electric instrument. Everybody else is all acoustic, you know, with the Big Town Playboys. And he also did Frankie's House, but he did it all direct. You know, he did that with a Digitech, you know, effects box, basically, that he put direct into. So he didn't have to have blazing amps in the studio, even.
Later on in his life, he became friends with Johnny Depp. Is that correct? And lived relatively near him?
Yeah, he met Johnny at an award show in England. And they were introduced. And it was just one of those things where... they just hit it off as buddies. They shared a same sense of humor, and they, you know, Depp, most people don't know this, but Johnny, he was a musician before he was an actor.
Sure, yeah.
Like, he had rock bands in Florida, and he moved to L.A. to basically make it big and playing in a rock band. Uh-huh. And so, you know, He was a musician, obviously admired Jeff. They hit it off. But they also met at a time in Johnny's life where Johnny was particularly vulnerable because he was going through a terrible divorce. The tabloids were chasing him around.
Yeah.
And Jeff was no fan of the British tabloids either. So he sort of offered Johnny a refuge in his mansion with his wife. And as Chris told you, Jeff's mansion is pretty isolated.
Yeah.
It's like in the middle of the British countryside. So it was a place where Johnny could get some peace. It was also during the time of COVID, so nobody was really going out. And after he stayed for a while, they did what musicians do. You know, they start jamming, they start playing guitars together, and you start creating.
Yeah.
And it was really at Jeff's behest, you know, that they started recording and making music together.
Yeah. Wasn't Lisa Marie Presley living in the same neighborhood as before she passed away, that is, as Jeff?
I'm not aware of that, to be honest. It's highly possible. I mean, it's a big expanse out there. It's isolated. It's really nice, you know, and everything. I mean, if you do want to get to London, it's an hour away, you know. There's no motorway, you know, that takes you directly there. You've got to go on a bunch of winding country roads, but you get there eventually. But if you want to stay away from people, I mean, that's talking about the tabloids, because there was a period in Jeff's life where the tabloids were trying to beat a path to his door, and not being too successful, because, you know, he is way out there. And so you can tell when somebody's coming up the drive or whatever, or trying, you know, they have to go over the wall like I did, you know, and then you're trespassing. Yeah, so.
Yeah. and was there a pub nearby where he lived?
There was a pub nearby, and he didn't go there very often.
Okay.
I asked him about that, because it's like, you know, there's great pubs. Britain has these wonderful, you know, the local, you know, down to your local, you know, get a pint of real ale, you know. But he said, like, yeah, I go out to my local, and it's like, there's always some bloke there, you know, singing Hi Ho Silver Lining at me when I walk through the door or whatever, you know. And it's like, I can't enjoy myself.
Yeah.
And it's funny because, you know, there used to be a thing like, oh, England was a place where celebrities never got bothered. Well, that changed at some point in history, where celebrities go out and there's just like almost like a hobby to, you know, take the piss, as they say,
sure,
you know, and harass celebrities, and they can't have a quiet night out. So, so Jeff just would stay in with his, you know, his scotch or his Prosecco or his ale, you know, and his dogs and his cats and his wife and a few friends who came down to see him.
Yeah. Did he take a lot of guests, a lot of visitors, or not?
Oh yeah, definitely.
Oh, he did.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, when I went there, Jed Lieber was staying over. Actually, you know who he did the Frankie's House soundtrack with, the you know, son of Jerry Lieber, sure, you know, the Lieber and Stoller.
Yes, of course.
So he was staying there with his girlfriend, and it was a big house. You know, like Robert Knight, the photographer, used to stay over there an awful lot, and everything. And then of course Johnny Depp stayed there, and yeah. I mean, you can go on and on with any number of people who were guests at the house. I think Jeff did enjoy having company.
Okay, very good. And so that for the two of you, I mean, obviously you're both very busy with Guitar World, but is there another book that's in the works?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we can't say much about it though. That's the only thing. So, okay. Because we've spilled the beans a little bit early before, and we've had other people try and steal our thunder. So we're not going to let that happen this time.
Makes sense, of course. Of course. And as far as Guitar World, is Guitar World working on a podcast? Is there a podcast related to Guitar World?
We're really not involved with Guitar World all that much. I still contribute, you know, a little bit. I do the back page. It's something called Power Tools with them. But, you know, Brad and I are basically writing books.
Okay.
So, and we'd probably do a podcast if we weren't so darn busy. Now, Brad does a great Substack.
Okay.
So I highly recommend that. But we leave it to you guys to do the podcast and, you know, and everything like that. And we'll be guests. We'll come in and talk your ears off. So
very good. And you're both guitarists, I take it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes.
And absolutely. Can you, if you wouldn't mind, can you just give us a little rundown of what your prized possessions are as far as guitars?
Okay. Let me start off by saying I have over 160 guitars.
Wow.
About 100 amplifiers, 500 effects pedals. My favorite, you know, out of my stuff, actually, the one guitar that I wanted since I was younger and could never afford, and finally reached a point where I could afford one, it was a Hamer Standard Custom. And I got one from Joel Danzig at Hamer.
Wow.
Just before Hamer closed up shop, but also the last of the Bound and Crowned, as they call them. You know, so it was, and Joel sent me over about four different ones to choose from, you know, pictures. And I loved the flame on this one, and I had to have the crowns, you know, I had to go the traditional route and everything like that. So that, I would say, is prized. Then I have incredible acoustics. That's really where I think my, you know, the best stuff in my collection, the creme de la creme. I have a lot of electrics, but I have mostly oddballs, you know, stuff, and decent stuff, you know, and everything. But my acoustics, I have a couple Stefan Sobel acoustics, a New World model that's beautiful Brazilian rosewood. And I also have a Domingo Esteso Flamenco.
Wow.
That's phenomenal. As well as a... I can never remember the name of the guy, but it was built in 1900.
Wow.
He's the guy who built, you know, guitars, built Segovia's 1912 guitar. And this one was actually, I think, the first one he built of the new century of 1900, because it's serial number 01, even though it wasn't his first guitar.
Okay. Do you seek these guitars out?
Not as much as I used to. I think I've reached critical mass. You know, I live in a decent sized house, but it's not that big. And I've got a basement that I have to, like, I basically have to do an archaeological dig to cut a path through if I want to get to something. It's, you know, where is that, whatever, you know, that Washburn acoustic, or where is that, whatever, you know, it's buried way back here.
Yeah.
You know, I have to say, I also have a beautiful Gibson, is an L2.
Oh, wow.
So that's a 31 with the Antigua finish and kind of the sparkle that very short period that they did. 31, actually, I think it was a 31. But
wow.
That's and it's in immaculate condition, and it sounds like a dream.
Excellent. And how often do you play guitar?
Not as often as I'd like.
Yes. That's our answer.
Too busy writing. I have two pedals that I bought recently that I haven't even plugged in yet. So that's give you an idea.
And you, Brad?
Well, I'm goofus to Chris's gallant. I don't have that many guitars. I mean, I've lived in small New York apartments all my life. But I'm not really geared that way. I really I really like to get an instrument that I love and use that and feel that. I think that was maybe left over from when I was a kid and I didn't have much money and much access. I would just make the best out of what I have. But I have a few really nice pieces. I say I have everything. I have everything I need from the various food groups.
Uh-huh.
I've got a nice Les Paul, like one of the custom shops, the Jimmy Page number two, with all the weird bells and whistles and all the funny little knobs that Jimmy created.
Be Bender? It's
2009. No B Bender on it. No B Bender. But it's a really, really good. It's a really good Les Paul.
Uh-huh.
You know? And it feels good, you know, to play. And then I have a nice Fender Custom Shop El Cabarita.
Oh, right.
You know, and I've got a Martin D28. And dude, I'm done. You know, I've got to tell you, I've got a Les Paul. I've got my acoustic guitar. And, you know, would I love to have as many as Chris? Not really.
Oh, yes, you would.
It would be too much to maintain.
It is too much to maintain. It's tough.
But I have to
correct myself. It was a 1930 L2, not a 31 or 32. So.
All right. Very good.
I know some of the listeners will call me out.
If any of your listeners are out there and they want to send me a really, really top grade acoustic, I'll take one if they want to send me one.
what are you plugging those two electrics into as far as an amp?
Oh boy. Again, 100 amplifiers. So, as a kid, I got a high watt, 50 watt.
Uh-huh.
So that was like a, you know, half stack. That's still kind of my favorite amp but then again, I have a 57 Deluxe that I picked up for a song in the 80s when nobody wanted Tweed amps in Hollywood.
Sure.
That's an incredible sounding little guy. And then I've got a Watkins. What's the model called? I have to look it up. This is when you have too much stuff, you can't remember what you have. let's see, my Watkins. Which one is it called? It's the little black and white one. They only made it for a couple of years. Scout. Watkins Scout.
Okay.
So it's like a little 12 watt. It's basically like the I can't remember the name of anything now. It's like the V front amp, the Dominator.
Mm-hmm.
But it's in a small, you know, single speaker type of, it's the same amp, you know, chassis basically, but with just a single little 10 inch speaker in it instead of two.
Yeah. Yeah. Very cool. And Brad, what are you playing through?
Well, you know, for a while I was playing through a Black Star just because it was a good, you know, portable amp and it seemed to split the difference between a Marshall and a Fender and I could get what I wanted to get out of it.
Yeah.
But I recently just picked up, because it intrigues me on a bunch of different levels, the new Positive Grid Reactor amp.
Okay.
First, it's a great sounding combo, but it has this artificial intelligence aspect to it that's pretty fascinating. I mean, not only can you get sort of like, you know, the standard, oh, you know, this Marshall, that, this Fender, this out of it.
Uh-huh.
But it has this app to it that, you know, you can actually take a picture of an effect or another amp and it'll analyze what that is and kick it back to you in your amplifier.
Oh, right on.
Or you can text into it. Oh, you know, I'd like to have Fender Twin and, you know, MXR, you know, phase 90, something sure. or other, and it'll create that. But the other weird thing is you can show it a picture of anything, like a painting in your room, and it'll interpret
what wow.
is into sound.
So,
or you can just describe something and type it in, like I want my amp to sound like a black Labrador Retriever or something, and it'll come up with that. So to me, it's sort of like really, I've just scraped the surface with it. I've just really started playing with it.
Yeah.
But it appeals to me because it just seems like something that like if I was Jimi Hendrix, you know.
Sure.
Like Jimmy would be like, yeah, man, you know, I want to put the rivers of Neptune in this thing and see what happens, you know.
Is it so it has some sort of AI feature to it where it can do that kind of stuff?
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, it has this app and AI. And it, and what's also good about it, again, because I said right now, I mean, I play mostly in my apartment. You can adjust it to either 100 watt, 50 watt, or a single watt.
Oh, wow.
You know, so you can, you know, put it on 1 watt, jack it up, and get a nice, healthy sound out of it.
Right on, right on. Well, it's been.
I know that sounds like heresy. It's probably like heresy to guys like you or Chris, but I'm finding it really, really quite excellent.
I just played a couple of shows with a band called Cowboy Mouth out of Louisiana.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah, I know Cowboy Mouth.
Yeah. And they're both the guitarists are playing. Actually, both guitarists and the bass player, they're using that quad cortex. And they were using. Like the first time my band played with them, they were using the original Kemper that they were playing through. Mm-hmm. I'd never seen anything like it, and it's fascinating and it's very efficient for them because these are fly dates. They're able to get their sounds just like the records and you know deliver a great show. And there I am.
It's easy on the back too.
Exactly. There I am lugging my Dr. Z combos and
Well, that's one thing I love about the Kemper is that you could do that snapshot because it's like I have an Axe FX 3 and I love it and it's great, but it's like you know what the 57 Deluxe and it doesn't sound like my 57 Deluxe.
Sure.
But the Kemper, I can dial in my 57 Deluxe and then take a snapshot of that. And then I've got that if I want to go out and gig or whatever. And I don't have to worry about it being stolen, you know, or whatever, God forbid.
For sure, for sure, for sure. Well, it's been wonderful talking to both of you. I appreciate your time. And I look forward to the next book. This book is wonderful. And I appreciate you guys speaking with me.
James, it's been a pleasure. Great. Always fun to talk gear. So.
Yes, exactly. Thanks, guys.
Have a great
afternoon.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening to Have Guitar Will Travel. You can catch up on all the things I'm doing at thedeadlies.com. And I'm on all the social media platforms as well. And please support Vintage Guitar and all the wonderful things they do because they do many, many wonderful things for us guitar players. Thanks. Please subscribe. Please tell a friend. And I'll see you guys next week. Bye, guys.